on Radio 4, Russell Davis unfolds the story of radio comedy once again. The Second World War continues, with some unusual alliances developing on the comedy front.
You sing, Mr. Robinson?
Oh, like a bird, a vulture.
You sing, Mr. Handley?
Like a dream, a nightmare.
Well, then, what are we waiting for? After you, Claude.
No, after you, Cecil.
Oh, Mr. Robinson.
Yeah?
Now, Mr. Robinson, you have just arrived here from the USA.
That's right.
And the question on my list is, do lemons kill aces? And do bananas turn the same old way?
Well, Mr. Andley.
Yes?
Yes, Mr. Andley.
Oh?
It's true, there's lots of fruit there, I agree. But there's still one here I see. It's the raspberry, I mean.
I don't get it, Mr. Robinson.
You will shortly, Mr. B. Mr. Handley.
Hello?
Or Mr. Handley.
Yes?
Is it true that here in England, more or less, fellows have no time to spoon underneath the silvery moon, and all the girls are in the ATS?
Oh, Mr. Robinson.
Now, Mr. Robinson. You must have heard that nonsense in a bar. Why, ever since the war, there's been more love than before. That's the berries, Mr. Handley.
No, the blackout, Mr. Robinson.
Yes, Tommy Handley of Hitmar and Edward G. Robinson of Hollywood. An unlikely partnership, but perhaps for that very reason, a useful symbol of the cooperation between the fighting allies in 1942. With America's forces now in the war, her radio artists and scriptwriters naturally came along as well, which wasn't necessarily to the liking of everybody in the comedy business. The feeling in the famous jibe, overpaid, oversexed, and over here, affected our local funny men from time to time, and a very dry and sardonic comedian like Ronald Franco was capable of sounding a bit grouchy about it, making some of his audience feel a bit puzzled, I sense.
You, the great British public, whose well-known artistic taste for higher wit before the war, so often elected with 74th in competitions for order of popularity, have, I am sure, little idea of the way in which we labour on your behalf. Alert or no alert, we always are. We never get any sleep, because in the earliest hours of every morning we have to listen into American jokes. And then spend the remaining pre-dawn translating them into English for you. After breakfast, tea and aspirin, we comedians send scores of priority telegrams to each other, stating in vain which of the American gags are now our own original and exclusive ones.
The American style that Franco felt he was being forced into was now widely heard in Europe, and we can sample a little of what he was on about in an extract from a program called, oddly enough, Command Performance, hardly the British idea of one. What it mainly shows is the sheer weight of celebrity that America could unload in one program, if it felt like it. Here, around the one microphone, are four world-renowned names. Bing Crosby, Judy Garland, a young man apparently built of pipe cleaners and bill cream, Frank Sinatra, and the ringmaster, Bob Hope.
Thanks, Judy, that was swell. You know, it's always a pleasure to hear you sing.
Oh, that's very sweet, Bob, but to tell the truth, I didn't come down here to command performance just to sing. I have something on my mind.
Me too, let's get out of here, huh?
Problem, and I want to ask you a big favor.
Well, sure, Jude. What is it?
Well, I know you're with Paramount, Bob, but you see, I'm making a musical for MGM, and I need a leading man. You must be very good-looking, tremendously talented, have loads of appeal for women, so naturally I came to you.
Well, gee, thanks.
I thought, sure, you could recommend somebody. The course for my next lead has just narrowed down to two men.
Two men?
Mm-hmm. Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra.
Well, go on. So far, you've only got a man and a half. Oh, Sinatra and Crosby, why don't you take me for your leading man? Forget about breathless and hairless.
Bob, my mind is made up.
But honestly, Judy, wait a minute. If you'd only reconsider, after all, what is Crosby, anyhow?
Don't nobody answer that.
Oh, hiya, Bing.
Hello, Bing. We were beginning to worry about you, Bing.
Really? Yeah, we're afraid you might show up.
Where's Frank Sinatra?
Well,
Roger Bing. I thought you were coming over together.
Well, we were, Judith, but I couldn't carry him another block. Stop him in the crowd.
What is the matter with her?
I think she just said it's Sinatra.
Yep, here he is.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Frank. I'm awfully glad you got here.
Well, every once in a while, one of those long shots come in.
How are you, Frank?
How would you know? Oh, I feel fine, Mr. Crosby.
Let's declare a little moratorium on the formality, Frank. He just called me Dick.
Oh, no, I wouldn't dream of calling a man of your years by his first name.
Mass stardom overcoming the woodenness of the setup in command performance. It wasn't the British style to concentrate the talent in that way. Rather, it was spread out over an increasingly vast range of entertainment programs, more and more of them aimed at particular national or armed forces audiences, some of them far off and reached by shortwave. Variety shows were now parceled out so that each particular branch of the uniformed services could feel there was a little patch of the airwaves that belonged to them. And the longest running of them, within the war itself, was the pet property of the Home Defense Systems.
For anti-aircraft and balloon commands and coast artillery, the 324th and final broadcast of Ack Ack Bear Bear.
And on came our genial host. The particular confidence exuded by Wing Commander Kenneth Horn, a blend of headmasterliness and businessman's bounce, was to turn him gradually into a kind of human maypole of radio comedy, around whom zanier talents would frolic. But for now, his duties were those of a basic chairman.
I forget how many times in the last 4 years our next artist has done his stuff and nonsense in this program. To be strictly truthful, he's been kept in a box in the studio and let out as required. But only this afternoon he just happened to escape. Play comparative silence, then, for Corporal Bill Waddington.
You seem to be in high spirits today, Bill.
Yes, I am, yes. I'm very high spirited just now. I've taken a new hobby on. I'm doing a bit of bird hunting.
Oh, really?
Yes, I was up with the lark this morning and out with the wren last night.
Yes.
I've got a friend of mine, he keeps a poultry farm. He said to me the other day, he said, you know, Bill, a single hen can lay 500 eggs a year. I said, is that so? He said, yes, it is. I said, how many do the married ones lay? He said, nice, sir, yeah. Yeah. And I noticed she was smelling very nice, you know, lovely smell. I said, what's that? Is it the air cream? He said, yes. I said, what is it? He said, that Homme de la Paris, 18 shillings a bottle. I said, have a smell at that. He said, good gracious, what is it? I said, petrol, you can't get it at any price.
Aye, the same Bill Waddington we've been watching in latter years as Percy Stogden on Coronation Street. For listeners who tired of the variety format, there wasn't very much relief, but there was some, pioneered from the middle of the war by the journalistic and literary wit Stephen Potter, with the subtle help of a new accomplice, Joyce Grenfell. Between them, they worked up some instructive entertainment, which gradually turned into what the BBC likes to call an occasional series, a how-to series. By 1943, the war was going well enough for them to consider the problems of how to give a party. As you'll hear, the style of production owed a lot more to drama than to music hall.
Charlotte,
could I have a word with you?
Charlotte, what?
Did you want the sausage rolls now or later?
Oh, are they ready yet?
Oh, they're ready. But I didn't know if you wanted them to save for later.
Nobody else be going round now. Charlotte!
That man is an accomplice.
Fascinating.
That man really writes very poems about the lake's longing and the garden of recollection.
Yes. Even the back of his head is fascinating to me.
Let's have the back of his head.
Excuse me, Marion, I must just have a word with Charlie. Charlie, there's a perfectly strange man juggling with some mince pies in the dining room, and I know he's going to break a glass or something.
Well, what do I mean to do?
Well, this is your house, Mosey. Your glass is just as much as mine, so go on.
I don't know what I'm going to say.
I expect you get thousands and thousands of letters, don't you, about your music, Mr. Martin?
I did get a letter last week from a lady who didn't seem to like it. She was very down on it.
It's always been my ambition to be able to make music. I suppose you started from the cradle, Mr. Martin.
No. As a matter of fact, I was a schoolmaster in Cape Town for a number of years.
Oh, yes, of course you were.
Quiet, but sometimes exquisite comedy of Stephen Potter and Joyce Grenfell, offering a lovely change of pace to exhausted wartime nerves. What most listeners seem to need, though, was the boisterousness of stage humour, with the communal comfort of audience reaction thrown in. The fact of laughter was perhaps a better tonic than the material itself. Here's an example that ought to have been typical, but turned out dramatically different. It's the start of a corny crosstalk, old-fashioned but fondly received, from a seafarer's show called Shipmates Ashore. It was broadcast from London because by 1944 comedy had returned from North Wales to the capital on the assumption that the worst of the Blitz was over, which in terms of saturation bombing it was. But there were new dangers in the air.
Let's turn the telescope on Claude Halbert, now appearing in Panama Hattie, and Enid Trevor.
Here I am. I just made most amazing discovery. They are absolutely necessary in all walks.
What are absolutely necessary in all walks of life?
Feet.
Super ridiculous. Where have you been?
I've just been outside of...
Not many laughs ensued, but you can hardly blame the performance. In fact, all praise for trooperism to Enid Trevor, bashing straight on while the debris was still in midair. Since that was June the 30th, 1944... The bang must have been a V1. They'd just started coming over a little over a fortnight before. It missed anyway, but not by much. And for a horrible moment, a workaday comedy show had been thrust into the front line. The show that pursued our troops most enthusiastically around the theatres of war was Merry-Go-Round. Middle East Merry-Go-Round, as it started off, then Mediterranean Merry-Go-Round, and finally splitting into three editions for Army, Navy, and Air Force. The Army version, subtitled Studio Stand Easy, became the domain of Charlie Chester and Company. The Navy one was the jumping-off point for Eric Barker.
Break! Carry on smoking. I have a few announcements here for anybody who's interested. Silence! Leave will be cancelled next weekend. As nobody's come back from last weekend yet, it won't make the slightest difference.
In peacetime, that show would become Barker's feature, Waterlogged Spa, a location not unlike the one where the RAF merry-go-round was set. Their location, in fact, would eventually become the peacetime title of the series. But in these wartime days, it was merely the refrain of this well-remembered song.
Landing in the last. Concealment is a thing that we've relied on.
That much, finding in the last.
We like to keep the place from being spied on.
To camouflage the aeroplane instead of using net.
The other day we painted it, but much to our regret.
We did it so successfully, we haven't found it yet.
That much, finding in the last.
Wing Commander Kenneth Horne again, and Squadron Leader Richard Murdoch, whose musical aptitudes were sometimes put to more satirical use.
Ladies and gentlemen, the stink box.
Do I worry? Cause you're sitting out. Do I worry? Cause you've got me in doubt. Though your kiss is outright. Do I give a bag of pins? Do I stay home every night and read my magazine?
Am I curious when the goblet flies? Am I curious about your little white lies? And when all our evenings end, because you've got a sick friend who needs you, do I worry, honey?
You can take your life, baby.
Do I worry?
Why does the breeze against
me? Am I curious?
Of the
the inkspots coming in for a gentler ribbing than some Americans of the time were getting. But little niggles of that kind were of absolutely no account when set against the news of the progress of the war, which, while not relentlessly good, did go on improving and accelerating until...
This is London calling. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead. I'll repeat that. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
News which can have dismayed only the most desperate of scriptwriters, who were thereby deprived of the best ever target for insult gangs. Within days, the war was at an end, and Churchill, using a phrase which in its puritanical restraint was worthy of Sir John Rees, was saying,
"We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing."
Which was marked by a victory edition of more or less everything, above all, the by now sanctified Itmar.
Hello, Julian Nelson.
Hello. Well, you know, tell me, why are you standing on one leg?
Well, sir.
Now, don't tell me. So it was you I saw posing as Eva in Piccadilly on Tuesday.
Oh, sir, I did enjoy myself.
Really?
Every time I waved my flag, I found myself on top of a taxi with a soldier.
Well, you were lucky to get one. I came home by underground. I slipped down a manhole and caught the last train.
The sailors were a bit saucy.
Oh?
There was one kid bumping into me and calling his little collision mat. He fell for me in a big way, sir.
Well, did he jump off the lamppost and land on your quarter deck? What about the RAF?
Oh, sir. What a flighty lot. Why, they wanted me to do the victory roll.
Well, you shouldn't do your hair up in a bun. I thought you were a piece of cake. Anyway, Mrs. Mop, I want you to appear in my victory parade.
Not as a diver, sir. I'm sure that's when I caught my rheumatism.
Well, you must have sat on a damp horse.
And Tommy Handley, who more than anyone else had embodied the uncrossable high spirits of the nation, led the tribute to Churchill, who had embodied its indomitable fighting instinct. The song may sound slightly fatuous now, but it must have been great fun to sing it in May 1945.
We follow the man whose master plan has carried us through the war. One for the old Havana. We follow him right to beauty. We're glad we walk behind the man who smoked the big cigar.
Of course, this wasn't the end of the entire struggle by any means, as the variety head John Watts was careful to remind listeners on another victory show, the Victory Party.
Don't think, please, because we're throwing a party that we've forgotten that there are men still fighting in the Far East. They're all far from home, but they're not forgotten. But this is victory in Europe. It is the end of phase one, and we're all due for a little rejoicing before we get on with that other war.
In order to cater for what did tend to become forgotten armies in the Japanese war so far away, special SEAC shows, Southeast Asia Command, were organized to maintain the morale of those involved at first or second hand in that conflict. At one of these in Leeds, the incredible Stainless Stephen resurfaced yet again to tell of his troop entertaining travels in Burma. His method hadn't changed a bit. Still the aldermanic delivery, still the clearing of the throat after the punchline, and still he got away with it.
But you know, folks, I'm very, very proud of this jungle uniform of mine. This is all I wore out here with those very, very gallant lads in Burma. I did most of my shows standing on jeeps, on ammunition boxes. As a matter of fact, one particular show I did on the gallows at Camilla. There was a great deal of wishful thinking, but I'm still here yet. I want to tell you a bit about Burma, folks, as you've all got interest over there. It's a wonderful country. To say that the wise men come from the east, by God, what I saw of it, I don't blame them either. The climate is over there, Mr. Hammond, 110 degrees in the shade. Talk about being on Elsie Moor, about that. I was walking up and down India, about that collar, about tie, about shirt, and about hat. Before I'd been there a month, I was back and his skin on my back as well. An American colonel's got eagles on his shoulders, that two vultures on mine for a fortnight. I went from there to a spot called Gahima up in the Chin Hills, 8,000 feet above sea level. We had to bend down at night to let the moon pass.
So the radio stars of 15, even 20 years before, still seem to be around. And it was left to one of the most durable of them to celebrate the very end of war on VJ Day, while incidentally paying tribute to some of the personalities who had made wartime civilian life worth living. And here he is.
Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Long.
With the most appropriate song I can think of for today. It's a song called The Victory Ball. And we've set the world to rights again and victory in our laps. We turn up all the lights again and polish off the jets. We'll have a jubilation, a beer and a spree, with all the allied nations celebrating victory. High and low, great and small, we'll all be dancing at the victory ball. All be making movies, trying to relax, never caring something for your income tax. Teddy Brown is coming with an actual admirer. He'll do an acrobatic stunt, dancing on the wire. And Vera Lynn will want to set the world on fire on the night of the victory ball. High and low, great and small, we'll all be dancing at the victory ball, shouting out a chorus, jigging up and down, Richard Talbot singing knees up Mother Brown. BBC announcers, though it's rather strange, will all be coming to retire into a range for dear old Stuart Hibbert to play blimey for a change. On the night of the victory ball, high and low, great and small, we'll all be dancing at the victory ball, singing Rule Britannia, shouting you hooray, won't go home the morning till the break of day. Dear old Winston Churchill, looking frightfully fit, with the biggest and the fattest cigar he's ever lit, and treating Lady Astor to a double gin.
Old Teeth and Trousers, Norman Long. And there were already new comedy stars among the returning forces. Victory's Star Show featured a young man with a hyphen called Terry Thomas, whose war memoirs were an extension of the silly ass comedy of the 30s, with a little more satirical sting. Well, anti-heroic, anyway.
To bring this story all the way back to date, in 1940, I received the most cunningly worded invitation to join the army. At the bottom of this illuminating address was the letter RSVP. Regimental Soldare Vaccinati and America. Which in translated to the Greek means, if you don't turn up, it'll be just too bad.
Wartime overall had tended to encourage quantity in comedy, necessarily at the expense of concentrated quality. It has also set up an interesting tension between the American way of presenting radio and our own. And one new and popular show more or less dramatized this very difference.
What are women wearing in shoes this year?
Feet!
Correct. Pay that man $5. What is an unlucky man?
A man who gets the itch and a broken arm at the same time.
Correct. Pay that man $10. And then, ladies and gentlemen, you have two sublimely happy men because...
Ignorance is bliss. And as living proof that it's folly to be wise, we present three inmates from a fool's paradise, Mr. Michael Moore, Miss Gladys Hay, and Mr. Harold Barron.
In effect, what happened in Ignorance is Bliss was that the three British knockabout comedians were constantly escaping and subverting the control of the would-be smooth North American question master figure, played by Stuart McPherson, who was actually a Canadian. The results were often more raucous than polished, but then the title made no secret of that.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, here is the next question, so give me your undivided attention. This one comes from Veronica Story of 5 Broxash Road, West Side, London. And she asks this. A car is traveling at 50 miles per hour. How many miles per hour does another car go if it is traveling at the same speed?
Here, is that all one question?
Of course it is. What did you think it was?
I thought you was reading the 10 o'clock news.
Well, it's a perfectly simple question. Mr. Moore, would you like me to repeat it?
No, thank you, Mr. McPherson. That won't be necessary.
Then you know the answer.
No, I decided to sit this one up.
I see.
Why don't you ask me if I know the answer?
Well, do you?
No.
Miss Hay, why don't you use the water on your brain to go bathing? And look, we'll take the question a bit at a time. A car is traveling at 50 miles per hour.
What might you think?
How many horsepower?
How many people?
Look, wait a minute. A car is traveling at 50 miles per hour.
Where's he going?
He's not going anywhere in particular.
Then what's all the big canary for?
It's people like that what causes all these accidents. 50 miles an hour, he don't know where he's going. What a geezer.
What a geezer. A catchphrase, of course. Incidentally, when Stuart McPherson was ill one week, his deputy, chosen for a near North American manner at the microphone, was a very young man called Eamon Andrews. This single performance was heard by Angus Mackay, the senior sports producer, and he took Andrews on to fame and fortune. Not that those could buy you much in austerity Britain, where the sight of a banana or a pineapple was rare enough to draw a crowd of curious onlookers, and the appropriate thing to do with a sausage was to toast it. If the meat shortage had one historical justification, it was that it provided the finest hour of the comedian Suzette Parry. Her method had changed, just a little bit, because she dropped some of the old-fashioned char-lady wobble in the voice and become instead the suffering austerity housewife, wrestling with the shortages. This recording carries no scriptwriter credit, but it is the most brilliant parade of innocently suggestive phraseology. The sort of thing you could imagine, say, Alan Bennett drawing inspiration from in his boyhood.
Got a bit of news for you. I've changed my butcher now. Oh, I was losing so much weight. My goodness, yes. I've gone to Mr. Chitterling down the road there. Because I've known old Charlie Chitterling for years, you know. He had a boy and girl love affair together. But he's married now with grown-up responsibilities. But when I went into his shop and he was registering me sort of all for, you know, like, I said to him, now, look here, Charlie, hope you're going to treat me nice for old time's sake. He said, I will, Susie, but not in front of a shop full of customers. Kept his word, too. Oh, yes. That evening, while I was sitting in my own light, I heard a flop in the hall, see? And he pushed a pound of sausages through the letterbox. They were tied in a true lover's knot. with a little card on them for old lang syne. Of course, I went into him next morning to thank him. He said, don't thank me, thank the lady who left them on the counter 3 weeks ago. Yes. But, you know, I had to leave me old butcher. I couldn't stand it. And, you know, at one time I thought there was going to be romance between us. Well, any girl would. I'll tell you what happened. It was during the war, it happened. I went into his shop, you see, and slipped on a piece of gristle. Well, when I came to, I was laying across his chopping board. He was spanging me with a piece of liver. He was looking down into my eyes and calling these workers playtime. And, you know, when I got home, I found he'd tucked a couple of kidneys underneath me fork and of a slab.
Absurd, you may say, but actually so very close to real life at that time. I remember the cues, not to mention the meat. No, the boys who were destined to take radio over the far edge of real absurdity were just struggling out of their uniforms.
Land ahead!
I should have said that sooner, shouldn't I?
Michael Davis wrote and presented The Story of Radio Comedy. The producer is Neil Cardle. And the next edition of Radio Fun veers strongly in the direction of not only the early Goons, but also Max Wall, Archie Andrews, and others.